Welcome to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEACT Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. This holiday season, we're sharing some of our favorite interviews from throughout the year. First up, a look back at our conversation with Rebecca Traister, author of the New York Times bestseller, All the Single Ladies. Later in the episode, Liz Winstead, comic and co-creator of The Daily Show, on using comedy to ensure women get to keep control over our own bodies.
You've got us 24 hours a day on your mobile smartphone via the Progressive Voices app. This is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
You're listening to Talk Poverty Radio. I'm Rebecca Vallis.
And I'm Tracy Ross. In 1960, 60% of Americans were married by age 29. Today, that figure has dropped to just 20%.
What does the rise of the single woman mean economically, socially, politically, and sexually? Is it something to be celebrated or to be feared? Rebecca Traister, a writer at large with New York Magazine, joins us to discuss her New York Times bestseller, All the Single Ladies, which explores these questions and more. Rebecca Traister, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you so much for having me.
So I find it somewhat irresistible to kick off this conversation with Susan B. Anthony, right? Early on in the book, you sort of frame her as a prophet, and you quote her at length from what you describe as a clairvoyant speech that she gave in 1877 on single women. And in that speech, you quote her as predicting that, quote, as young women become educated in the industries of the world, thereby learning the sweetness of independent bread, it will be more and more impossible for them to accept the marriage limitations that husband and wife are one. And mm-hmm. And she continues that that this will lead us, quote, inevitably to an epoch of single women. Are we living in that epoch today, and how did we get here?
It is the premise of my book that we are living in that epoch today, and it's going to last a while, and and things are changing all around us. So it's difficult to make firm proclamations about what's going to happen during this epoch. but we got here as part of a long story that actually, was already unfolding in Susan B. Anthony's day in the 19th century and that she was a part of. We have seen since this country's founding, a story of shifting policy around who in this country has access to power, to economic power, to political power, social and sexual and familial power. And so much of that story, as it turns out, as I learned when I was writing my book, is woven around the history of marriage patterns and specifically around women who lived independently from marriage, the institution that organized economic and social and sexual power in this country for a very long time, and increasingly is not the only organizing institution.
In one of the book's early chapters, you take the reader back to Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas's confirmation hearings and to the infamous Anita Hill testimony. She, of course, was the law professor who testified that she had been sexually harassed by Clarence Thomas while she was clerking for him. And she ended up being almost on trial herself when the members of the Senate Judiciary Committee questioned her mental stability and her credibility, in large part because she was a 35-year-old woman who had chosen to pursue a career and to remain single. So clearly a lot has changed.
Yes, and I realized that I was remiss in my last answer. I gave a whole history of single women and didn't explain the second half, which is how, as this becomes a more normalized experience and really disrupts the way that things have gone before, and Anita Hill is a perfect example of this, because it's threatening when women are living outside of the institution that has historically contained them. And by many measures, controlled them and defined them and on which they were dependent. When they become independent of that institution and they become independent in other ways, professionally, economically, they become real threats. And Anita Hill was a perfect example of that, even though in her actual project, which was telling the story of the sexual harassment she experienced whilst a colleague of a nominee to the Supreme Court, Clarence Thomas, he was confirmed despite her testimony. So in that way, she didn't undo him. But the idea that this woman could be a professional peer of, have an equivalent education to, a man who is being nominated for the Supreme Court of the United States, That was pretty threatening in and of itself. The fact that she was unattached from marriage, and this is something that she herself wrote about, interestingly, I didn't realize this until I started writing my book and interviewed her. She herself had written about the role that her single identity played in making her vulnerable to insults and stigma thrown at her by the Senate Judiciary Committee and by critics of what happened. The people on the Senate Judiciary Committee depicted her as perverse, as pathologically lonely, as sexually desperate. David Brock famously referred to her as a little bit slutty and a little bit nutty. She was made extra suspect by the fact that she was unmarried. And so, but it's interesting that the thing I was going to say about the stigma persisting and in some ways intensifying as women live independent of marriage in greater numbers is that in part that's the reaction. On the one hand, it's becoming a much more normalized experience so that, for example, your friends who call themselves the San Francisco spinsters can adopt and reappropriate language that had been diminishing historically and have a sense of humor about it because their experience is increasingly normalized. At the same time, the pressures, the threat that the normalization of single life for women creates means that people who are upset about it, threatened by it, confused by it, get increasingly agitated and want to punish those women even more. And so what you see are increasing messages about fetishizing weddings, for example, the rise of the wedding industrial complex, the say yes to the dress, the social media obsession with, you know, engagement ring shots and wedding photos and all that kind of stuff. It can feel like the pressure to marry and to consider marriage as the peak achievement of female adulthood. Anachronistically, it can feel like that's building even as marriage becomes less and less the peak achievement of female adulthood, if that makes any sense.
And I think a compounding effect of the Anita Hill situation is that this was a woman of color. And you talk about the issues of intersectionality within singledom. Obviously, she was economically privileged, but there are differences between how women of color, how poor women are seen in this country. And you write that while the victories of independent life are often emblematized by the country's most privileged women, the war was fought by many Americans who have always had far fewer options to live free, women of color, poor, and working class women. And you know, how do these, I guess, the shift really play out? Because, again, you note that there's a fetishization of marriage, but that's of a much more privileged class with, you know, the rings and the dresses and all of that. But, you know, the liberation of the single women has largely been from people who need more freedom.
Well, it started with people who had far less freedom and opportunity to begin with, and who often were walking away from marriage, not even walking away from marriage, not marrying, marrying less often and later, in response to economic challenge. So in the current iteration of this, if you look at the history, in the middle of the 20th century, the very famous story of the mid-20th century America, the sort of emblematic story, is one of the rise of the white middle class, the post-depression, post-war white middle class, buildup of the nuclear family in which domestic servility was kind of enforced for middle-class white women. And the government funded all these, the creation of these suburbs and the building of these houses and the building of highways that would connect white men from their jobs in the urban centers to their government-subsidized housing in the new suburbs. After servicemen returned from the war, white returning servicemen were far more able to take advantage of the GI Bill that would send them to college. Black returning servicemen were far less able to do so because they were far less likely to be admitted to colleges. All these same mechanisms that were helping to build and help the white middle class flourish in the United States in the mid-20th century were cutting off black families from a lot of the same resources, so that those highways were being built through black neighborhoods and cutting black neighborhoods off from the urban centers where there were jobs and opportunity. Of course, many of those government subsidized, and this is something that Tom Sugrue and Ta-Nehisi Coates have done a lot of writing about, and I cite them in my book, that those white suburbs were built exclusively for white families, and black families were excluded from them. Black neighborhoods were redlined. Black homebuyers were charged usurious mortgage rates. The possibility for building that kind of nuclear mid-20th century middle-class family was actually made totally inaccessible to black families. And in the face of this economic challenge, marriage began to make much less sense. If you don't have, if there aren't jobs, if there aren't homes in which you can, jobs to be hired for and homes in which you can move and, public schools that are going to educate your children well, then this aspirational middle-class nuclear family, patriarchal male earner and a domestic unpaid wife at home to do the child care makes much less sense. It's just not tenable. And so what you saw was a drop in black marriage rates in the 1950s moving into the 1960s. And it came not only at the same time, but in relationship to the buildup of the white middle class that was in many other ways cutting white women off from opportunities that they'd had in the early 20th century. And so what you get in 1963, you get Study for Dance, a Feminine Mystique, which was very famously, the sort of explosive feminist cry out of those suffocating white middle-class suburbs for women. And in 1965, you get the Moynihan Report, which was the report on systemic black poverty, which in many ways was a very thoughtful document and documentation of the history of systemic inequality experienced by African Americans. But in another way, sort of circled around this one center of what Moynihan saw as pathology, which was women-headed households, single women, single black women. And so it's impossible. In the mid-20th century, it was black women who stopped marrying first in response to economic conditions. You can see this. And then when that behavior, because it does, it then displaces marriage as the institution that organizes gendered power. And when that behavior begins to spread to more privileged communities, and get repeated by more privileged people who have more resources with which to make their independence look attractive and, in fact, be more appealing, then it becomes discernible as liberation. So then you get Sex and the City. And that is a pattern that is repeated often in America's history. I mean, working for wages outside the home. Obviously, women who have worked for wages outside the home have been poor and working class women throughout history out of necessity, and often women of color. But, and of course, working outside the home for wages, while incredibly difficult and physically taxing, in many cases dangerous, and low paid, and, it also has offered, and this is something that Sadie Alexander wrote about in the early 20th century in advance of Betty Friedan, it also offered women kinds of satisfaction, kinds of economic power. It was Sadie Alexander, who was a black lawyer in Philadelphia, was arguing that this was good for women and good for their families. She was arguing this in advance of Betty Friedan, and she was arguing it about women of color who had long worked outside the home for wages. When that behavior, which did offer women many benefits, got repeated by women who had more resources to start with and more privilege to start with, then it becomes discernible as the feminist revolution of the 1970s, women moving into workplaces. So this is a pattern of an appropriation of behavior that is often enacted in response to challenging economic conditions. But when it is mimicked by women with more resources, it becomes legible to us as political revolution. But it's often women of color who are the pioneers of these behaviors, and that is true for the changing marriage patterns as well. And yet, we still continue to look on women of color as victims, and the white women who repeat their behaviors as political groundbreakers.
And I want to dig a little bit into that, right? So I love the way that you put this in one portion of the book. You say that, quote, privileged women no more invented liberation from marriage than they invented the idea of working to earn wages, which I feel like so beautifully captures exactly what you've just been articulating and sort of tracing back throughout time. But I want to dig a little bit into that that clash that very much still exists today, right? It didn't go the way of the Moynihan Report in the rearview mirror. It's very much still with us today, which is our society historically, but still very much today, blaming many, if not all, of our social ills on women, but particularly women of color, and particularly women who are single mothers of color. And we see that a lot in the politics of how we talk and think about poverty and how we talk and think about welfare.
Right. Well, this is one of the things that I argue in my book that I think conservatives will take strong exception to. It is conservative dogma that the way to address poverty is through a reinstatement of early hetero marriage as a social norm. And they say this very directly in a million different ways. They say it, it's like shooting fish in a barrel to get one of them saying it. Marco Rubio has said, we have a program that will end poverty. It's called marriage. Mitt Romney, when asked in a 2012 debate against Barack Obama what would stem the tide of gun violence, said people should get married. He has given commencement speeches urging young people to marry, not just more often, but early. And you see, I mean, this is, it really is, it's just, this is the pervasive idea of conservatives, that because it is true that that unmarried mothers in particular face very high rates of poverty. 42% of single mothers live below the poverty line. Half of minimum wage workers are single women, many of them mothers. This is the kind of thing that is a national crisis, but the fix, as we know, right? We live in a country that is riven by economic inequality. But for conservatives, the fix is reestablish marriage. I believe the absolute opposite of this. I believe that we need to better economically bolster through, expanded welfare programs, expanded healthcare benefits, expanded, revised social policies, raised minimum wage, that if we provide more stable economic conditions for the United States, that's the approach to alleviating poverty. And that as a side benefit, it will likely, I don't much care whether it improves marriage rates. I have no investment in whether people marry more or less, but I certainly think that economic stability makes for more stable relationships between people and more stable families and more stable kids. And so to me, it is self-evident. And in fact, there are actually programs. One of the interesting things is that, the United States has spent hundreds of millions of dollars on the Healthy Marriage Initiative, which was started in the Bush administration. And it was meant to encourage marriage and educate people about marriage and encourage early marriage, and it was meant to be in part an approach to poverty, and it was continued by the Obama administration, although it changed and emphasized education about parenting more, but it had no impact on it did nothing to raise marriage rates at all. And the only public policy approaches that have actually shown signs of boosting marriage rates and marriage longevity are ones that expanded welfare benefits. In Milwaukee, Wisconsin, there was an anti-poverty program called the New Hope Project, and it was in the mid-90s, and it provided full-time workers whose earnings were below 150% of the federal poverty level with income supplements, and offered those who were unable to find work community service jobs and subsidized health care. The study of marriage rates showed that 21% of never married women who participated in that project were married 5 years later, compared to 12% of never married women who did not participate. In Minnesota, the Minnesota Family Investment Program allowed people to keep their welfare benefits as opposed to cutting them off after they found jobs, and the divorce rate for black women in the state fell by 70%. So there's actually evidence, even though my interest is not in raising marriage rates, though that seems to be the interest of many conservatives. But it seems self-evident to me that marriage becomes untenable in economically challenged circumstances, and that if we created through social programs, as we know we have the ability to do by creating more robust welfare benefits, by offering Americans with no safety net a much stronger safety net, you're going to see increased stability, which increases the ability of adult human beings to have stable relationships.
And a point that a colleague of ours, Sean Fremstad, whom you know often...
Good work I admire so much.
And he would say the same of you. We'll channel him here for you. A point he often makes and which just needs to be said again and again so that people stop just hearing the all the quotes you mentioned, right? Marriage is the panacea to everything in the world.
Right.
Is that There are more married people in poverty in this country than never married people.
Right.
And sort of a continuation of that conservative line of thinking is one that you take down really explicitly in the book, which is that single women are somehow looking for the government to create a, quote, hubby state for them. You argue that actually what we've long had in this country is a wifey state for men. What do you mean by that? And how does that tie in with sort of the conservative line of thinking about marriage as the be-all and end-all?
Well, one of the things that conservatives who want to reinstate this early marriage model say over and over again is that single women want these changed social policies, whether that's subsidized daycare, paid leave, higher minimum wages, paid sick days, in part because they want to rely on government benefits as this, they want to rely on Uncle Sam as their husband. This is something you hear from conservatives all the time, talking derisively about unmarried women voters and why they vote Democratic, because Democrats support the social programs that make more sense. And, you know, to some extent, by the way, they are right that that unmarried women need better support from the government, and support in part in place of what used to exist as the, you know, when marriage was the organizing principle of adult life. But the problem with this is that this portrays women's need for support from the government as aberrant, as pathetic, when in fact men, and specifically white men in this country, have benefited from government support from the founding, whether that's come in the form of their right to vote, which was established at the founding for white men and has been protected ever since, whereas we know for women and people of color, it took centuries of death and fighting it in order to be able to get the vote. White men have, from the beginning of this country, had the ability to select a government that best represented their needs and served their needs. White men have benefited from educational loans, from housing subsidies, from tax breaks, from the building of the infrastructure that as the people, the class of Americans that ran the businesses and profited from them, you know, the United States invested in the infrastructure that permitted those businesses to thrive. White men have benefited hugely from the government, and what's more, they have benefited from the government's refusal to put in place similar protections for women, so that women's equal pay is not protected. There are still massive gendered and racial wage gaps that keep women's pay much lower than men's. There are not programs that support women's participation in a workforce, things like paid leave after the birth of children, or paid leave in the case of a gravely ill relative, where it's still women who are we still expect that there is a class of American wives who are not working, who are at home, who are going to take care of these things, who's going to pick up children at 3 o'clock in the afternoon or take care of them through our long summer breaks. Our country is organized around the idea that there is one kind of American, the husband, who is out in the public world having professional, economic, and political power, and that there's one kind of American, wives, who is at home doing the domestic and child care and enabling the husband's participation in the public sphere. And we're not organized that way anymore. And so it is absolutely true that women now require more support from the government, but it is a support that would only begin to get them up to speed with the kind of support that men have gotten. Because in depressing women's the ability for women to experience economic equality, you have also kept women off the playing field. You have basically left it open for men, and again, white men, to run their own table, to not have women competing with them for jobs until very recently, or for education until very recently. And in fact, women working to support their participation in the public sphere. And so men have benefited in every direction, white men, from government support for centuries. So when we suggest that women now should benefit from government support, I think that's only fair.
And another component of this war on women that we're seeing in public policy goes back to reproductive rights, which you mentioned earlier, marriage being an institution that was in part there to govern women's reproductive lives. But we've seen, with the rise in Supreme Court cases and horrible legislation across the country, attempts to roll back women's rights and access to abortion and birth control. Do you see this as part of a backlash to the rise in single women? Because abortion, anti-abortion advocacy hadn't always been a central part of conservatism. So, you know, how do you see this fitting in with the major points that you're making in your book?
I'm sorry, can you, I just lost you for that last question.
Oh, sure. Do you see this as part of a backlash to the rise in single women?
Oh, yeah. The backlash is intense. And I think that you're going to see it coming from pretty much every direction. There's going to be this emphasis, you know, and this has happened in the past. And in my book, I trace the history of the ways that when backlash came to women living independently, it came from every direction. You know, it's easy to conceive of backlash, you know, somebody says, oh, come on, it's not like there's, you know, one person sitting there saying, I'm going to reinstall women in the home, you know, and make them economically dependent on men again. It's actually all kinds of forces working at once. And I think that the backlash that contemporary single women are facing that is very real is because there is so much conservative investment in reestablishing marriage as the organizing norm. What you have is a real risk, because if you take away women's reproductive rights, which we know is happening around the country, if you do not protect their rights to equal pay, if you do not offer them support in the form of paid leave benefits, paid sick days, and of course all of these positions are ones that the Republican Party supports. If the Republican Party comes to even more power, they already have terrific power federally and in state legislatures around the country. If they gain more power, for example, in 2016 and then in 2020 and then, you know, 2018, as Republicans gain more power, they really do have the power to make women, to roll back the kinds of pieces of social progress that created the conditions that enable women to live outside of marriage. So if you roll back women's abilities to control their reproductive lives and make decisions about when and if and under what circumstances to have children, if you roll back their chances of educational and economic equality, which you do by, you know, doing away with affirmative action in part, if you roll back their voting rights, which you do by gutting the Voting Rights Act, here are some examples of how this is happening, you can recreate economic circumstances in which women don't have economic and social and sexual autonomy any longer, and it will force them to again be dependent on men and on marriage. So it's not like there's a degree to which backlash takes the forms of the messages in magazines and Steve Harvey yelling, in his case, particularly at black women about their empowerment and how it's going to leave them without husbands, and you have the all kinds of punishing pop culture messages that are still out there and the fetishization of yes, say yes to dress. But then you also have the very real political reality, which is that it is possible to make women dependent on marriage again, and that we could be an election or two or three or four away from a return to circumstances that would again make it very difficult for women to live outside of marriage.
Rebecca Traister is the author of the New York Times bestseller, All the Single Ladies. Thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you so much.
And as two single ladies who are loving your book right now, we'll let Beyonce take us out.
Hi, I'm Gianna Garrell from Progressive Voices. Today, the angry roar of the conservative media machine dominates TV and radio, threatening to drown out and push out anyone who dares to discuss our progressive perspectives and ideals. But we can't let that happen. We have too many strong, smart, and important progressive voices who need to be heard. That's why here at PV, we're building a 21st century progressive media universe. One where all the best in progressive media can come together, rise above the static and the noise, and be heard by anyone, anywhere. And we need your help. We're in the middle of a critical campaign to make our dream of 21st century progressive media universe a reality. But we can't do it without grassroots support from people like you. Head over to progressivevoices.com to see how you can help. Please support this important progressive mission, because with your help, we can make sure all our progressive voices are heard.
Welcome back to Talk Poverty Radio on the WEAC Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. I'm Rebecca Vallis. I'm here for an exceptionally fun segment, a little something different for the show. I'm hanging out with three comics, Liz Winstead, who is a co-creator of The Daily Show, and I'm sure will be known to listeners of this show. I'm also here with Joyelle Johnson and Sarah Thayer, and you guys are going to get to learn a little bit more about them momentarily, but I'm here speaking with them about the power of comedy as a storytelling method, an anti-stigma method when it comes to women, women's bodies, reproductive justice, and more. So with that, Liz Winstead, tell me a little bit about how you turned to using comedy around these issues.
I'm not sure I actually ever turned to using comedy around these issues. I think I always did to a certain extent. I think what I did was honed my issue to have it be more centered around reproductive access and rights. I have an organization called Lady Parts Justice, and it's a cabal of comics and writers and storytellers and performers who have decided to take some of their talent and put it towards busting stigma around abortion access and to calling out politicians. Sorry, Michelle Obama, sometimes I'm not always going to go high. It's just the truth.
Well, so tell me a little bit about, you guys have done a show now. This is the second year in a row that you've done it. It's a comedy show, and it really is focused on what you call abortion storytelling. Tell me a little bit about the show and what the storytelling looks like.
The show is centered around, this year, the last year was straight abortion storytelling. This year, we have four abortion storytellers, and then we have, I think, three or four other women who are going to be talking about what it's like to walk the earth while being female, and what that means, especially what that means in an era where literally a white supremacist is the head of the ticket on a major political party. So when Trump proposes his insanity, whether it's his hatred of Muslims, whether it's his hatred of Mexicans or immigrants, whether it's his despising of women, we have just found out by bringing on the head of the Susan B. Anthony Fund to run his quote-unquote pro-life agenda. There's a lot of people who have life experiences that would have been drastically affected by the ideas that he's proposing to put into law on a federal level. And we're going to hear comedy about that from all these different perspectives. And then we're going to hear some really incredible abortion stories. No one has the same abortion story. No one has had the same abortion. And for me, to hear the stories of people who've had them is incredibly important, because it is my firm belief that the best reason to have an abortion is because you need one.
Sarah Thayer, tell me a little bit about what made you want to be part of this effort, how you use comedy around this issue, and whether you're going to be telling one of your stories tonight.
Well, I've always been used comedy to talk about really horrible things, because I grew up in a really horrible family situation, and I developed a sense of humor pretty early on to cope with that and to cope with being bullied at school and all of those kind of things. And I'm before the phrases TMI and you know, all those other phrases of don't go there existed, I was already saying those things. And when it comes to abortion, I will be telling a story about having an abortion tonight. When it comes to abortion, I feel like it's not something that's talked about enough. And humor, by definition, is something that's shared among people with a common experience. And it makes women feel better to hear whatever your story is about your abortion. And that's my main goal, is to make women feel like your choice is valid. It might not be my choice. It might not be for the same reason that I made my choice, but your choice is valid for you. And I think using humor to do it is cathartic, and it's a release. And it, at the end of the shows of this nature, you just feel this loving warmth between the audience and you as performers. And so for selfish reasons, I do it for that. I do it for a little bit of loving warmth, but I want to share that with other women as well.
What other kinds of hard issues, which you mentioned it's not just abortion, have you taken on with comedy?
Poverty, child abuse, things that I experienced. I work at a volunteer at a shelter for women and abused women and children, and they have the best senses of humor of anybody I know. They don't want to, it's sort of like, they don't want to dwell in a sad place. They want to find that common humor language and talk about it, because it's a way for you to own what has happened in your life and then to move forward from that.
Joelle Johnson, same question to you. How did you get involved with using comedy over these kinds of issues?
Well, I started out as a comedian, and I would just talk about my own personal life, and most comedy comes from pain and struggle. So I talk about how I have a deadbeat dad, and last year was my first time doing my own abortion story on stage. It was my first time telling the story in public. And I just know the same thing, reiterating what both of them said, that it makes people feel better when they can hear someone telling their perspective, because that's what always made me feel better. You know, when I was growing up, I watched George Carlin, and I was like, oh, his politics makes sense to me. You know, and that's when I was going to Sunday school, and I was like, that doesn't make sense to me. So, you know, comedy was always the way that I made sense of things. And then later in life, The Daily Show became that for me, where I was like, that makes more sense than what those other people are saying. So, and I just became a part of Lady Parts Justice for being a comedian. And now I get to fight for women's rights. That's awesome.
What was it like telling a story about such a personal issue for the first time on a stage?
It was interesting. I cried on stage. We were just talking about that before. I'm a crybaby, but I never told the story before, so I didn't know how I was going to feel. And it felt great. I got a standing ovation, which was awesome. But I'm a person. I'm from New Jersey. I grew up and I live in New York. I'll cry on the subway. Like, I don't care about tears. So it doesn't bother me. I think tears are a good thing in life. So it was great. It was a great feeling telling the story. And people coming up to me afterwards just like, oh my God, you're so brave. I was like, oh, thank you.
So on a personal note, part of why I'm so excited to be talking to you guys and about the work that you're doing and what Lady Parts Justice does is I've had an abortion. It's a story that I've told on a one-on-one basis. It's a story I've told with friends. I've never told it on the air. So hello, listeners. I'm telling you now. But every time I tell the story to a friend or, you know, any other woman, I'm shocked to, and no longer so shocked anymore, to find how many times the response is, oh my God, me too, and I've never felt like I could tell someone. Is that something that happens when you do these shows, when you tell your stories, Liz Winstead? Is that one of the consequences you've seen of doing this kind of work?
Yeah, they come up after the show, they'll send you direct, you know, messages on Facebook. I mean, I've had a show, I did a talk at a college, and a young woman sent me a note saying, I saw your talk and I had an abortion the day before by myself. And then I didn't, you know, I wasn't alone. So I think those things are really important. And I think to emphasize the joy part, because I really feel like in our society, we've always stigmatized poverty, but now poverty in this country and in this sort of climate of antagonistic awfulness that I'm watching develop in this election season is that I feel like we don't have a media that calls horrible shit out, and poverty is now a character flaw, and I would like to do everything in my power to stop that from happening, because, and that's why using humor is so important. There's a great movie that's called Sullivan's Travels. It's one of my favorite movies. And it's a sort of lofty journalist. It's made in the 1930s. A lofty journalist who goes out to tell the story of the hobo and poverty, and he's gonna go out there and save some things. And what he discovers is that all these people who are poor, all they want to do is experience joy and laugh and have a good time like the rest of us. And so,
as if that's somehow surprising.
Yeah, and because we've stigmatized poverty so profoundly, we actually don't think people who are poor deserve joy, deserve to have their abortions paid for with the Hyde Amendment,
right.
Deserve to, you know, you see these people, why should we give people food stamps? We have to cut what you can buy on food stamps. Like, you can't have a cake, or you can't have a nice piece of fish or whatever. And so it's all tied in, and I get super frustrated when people are like, you know, women don't care about abortion, they care about the economy. And I'm like,
do you really, are you still standing before me with not a black eye? Because I'd like to punch you, because if you think that the economics of having children is not the first thing people think of, and that raising a family and everything else around that, it's not economic, then you've never fucking participated in the world or known people who are poor. And so I just, that's another part of this whole thing.
And that the continuation of that thought is that there's such a stigma against having a responsible abortion. And to say, and it is an economic decision so many times, and it's not an easy one oftentimes because it costs a lot of money. I'm going to talk about that in my piece tonight, how you have to, like, the cheapest abortion is the one without anesthesia.
Yeah, you know? I had that one.
Yeah, it is like, yeah, I did too.
But so I had a fancy one.
I had both. Cheap, the discount abortion, and the what would you call it, the Mercedes abortion.
I call it the fancy one.
Yeah,
abortion.
The fancy one. But I feel like to look at it as a decision I made, and I feel very comfortable saying this, it was a hugely responsible decision that I made, and a moral decision to not have a child at that time in my life, and to have an abortion was the moral choice. And so by talking about it in a public forum and on your podcast, people are going to hear that and see a different side of something and reduce the stigma against it.
And there's Amy Hagstrom Miller, who is the woman who owns the Whole Women's Health Clinics and was the woman who brought the Whole Women's Healthy Hellerstedt Supreme Court decision, says all the time, good women have abortions, period. You know, and that's just, you know, the bottom line. And so I feel strongly that, echoing everything that everyone here has said, there are no good abortions. There are no bad abortions. There's only the abortion that you need.
Well, but you're damned if you do, damned if you don't with this issue, right? Because we as a society have taken, and in many ways, not just in a partisan way, but on both sides of the aisle, to blaming this, quote, single moms, right? Those bad single mommies for basically every social ill that you can conceive of in this society, no pun intended, as I just say conceive. But at the same time, we stigmatize and blame people if they make the responsible choice not to have the child.
Yeah.
Yes,
it's responsible.
And then, I just think it's a very responsible choice. I have family members who shall remain nameless, but I have one family member who has been pregnant many times and is on her fourth child right now, and she can't afford that. And she's had abortions, but it's like, that's irresponsible. So what's the alternate is the Republicans want her to have these babies as a punishment for things. And like, she's using abortion as birth control. Good. Okay.
Just the whole notion of carrying a child to term and having a child as a punishment,
yes. Yeah,
is something that I think we are fighting against by talking about. Because it's like, no, not even just this shit is blamed on women. I feel like everything's blamed on women. And a lot of people want to return to a time where women didn't even leave the home without their husband's permission or wearing that 13-inch belt. It's important for us to get out there and be loud, because a lot of women don't. And this is another thing that I've had to learn to respect. When your friend, when you say, I've had an abortion, and your friends say, oh, so have I, but I would never tell anyone. I've had to learn to respect that their choice is to not talk about it and not be an advocate and not be an activist. And to say, well, then we'll do it for you.
That's right.
We'll go out and do it for you.
Yeah.
And I think that to me is that's one of the biggest lessons too, is that if you can't talk about it, hearing people talk about it over and over again gives you a community that you didn't know existed for yourself, and you can access those stories, you can access those Facebook pages, you can access Lady Parks Justice, you can access a lot of it. But I mean, to go back to all that is said, and Lady Parks Justice, we're a reproductive rights organization that focuses on access to abortion. The reproductive justice organizations are incredibly important, because they're really advocating for what happens when you decide to have a child. You know, what happens? I mean, they're doing amazing work, like finding prison doulas and doing all this really incredible work around the reproductive justice as it stands as a whole. And I just think it's so ironic that somebody would actually say to a person who doesn't want to have kids, or seems like, I'll hear people say, well, what do you say to the woman who's had four abortions? What should we do with her? And I go,
maybe not force her to be a mom. Because it seems like they're not that together to, like, do that. Well, so how about that?
Or they just don't want to do that.
Yeah, so why don't we shut the fuck up? How about if we don't do anything about them except help them in their decision that they make?
Yeah, or if a person is so irresponsible that they are using abortion as birth control, if you want to call it irresponsibility, you want that person to be a parent of all of these children that they would have had?
No, I think you want that person to have abstinence-only education, right? If we're going to take this...
Abstinence-only doesn't work. You want them to, like, have access to birth control.
I'm being sarcastic.
Sorry if that was unclear where I stand here. I'm channeling the person who blames this individual, right, and says that they are also the people who want to make sure we have abstinence-only education in our schools, which makes tons of sense if you're thinking of, oh, wait, no, it makes no sense at all.
Yeah.
Well, no one's ever had, I mean, either. Yeah, and also, there's no such thing as abstinence. Like, did you ever take that, remember the age of abstinence that you studied in college? No, people are not having sex because of some weird...
Yeah, remember when humanity just stopped for a while?
Yeah.
I remember that.
Yeah, I mean, people are trying to get laid, thinking about the next time they're gonna get laid, thinking about getting some food, thinking about getting laid again, movies, art.
It's like delusional to pretend that sex is always optional when we live in a country where clearly so many people are forced to have sex. So like, even if you wanted abstinence only, it might not be a realistic choice in a country such as ours.
Yeah. Maysoon,
hi, sorry, I'm not.
We've been joined by a fourth comic. So the party is getting more and more fun.
See, when you start talking about abortion, everybody wants to keep talking about it.
This is no longer going to be the quiet room. It's going to be the party room shortly. So, well, the more the merrier. Thank you for joining us. So I'm curious what kinds of pushback you guys ever get for doing this kind of work and possibly, you know, not just from one side of the aisle. Tell me a little bit about some of the criticism.
I mean, there's people who, I mean, I get everything from death threats to people who are, call themselves pro-choice, who say humor isn't a place to talk about this or to say, why do you have to swear? Why do you, this is my favorite thing. I would have donated to you until I saw how many times you used the F word. And I was like, A, you wouldn't have. And B, I don't worry about blowback. I worry about accessible information and giving people really interesting, compelling, authentic voices that they can grab onto so that they know that their abortion is a normal part of the human medical landscape that somebody might need to use. So I don't care about haters. I care about, the only time I care is if I were to put content out that I couldn't back up. Anybody who works with me will tell you I'm really, really, really nitpicky about every word that is said in a video, everything that's in a script, because I'm the one that's gonna have to defend it. And so when I know it seems outrageous a lot of times sitting around a writing room with me, because I'm like, we have to say it that way, that's not actually factually accurate, you know, that seems frivolous, but every single thing that's on our website I can stand up and say 100% I don't give a fuck what you think. That's changing the way somebody's gonna feel when they watch it.
So same question to you guys, what kinds of criticism, what kinds of blowback have you gotten being comics who take on these kinds of hard issues?
One of my favorite things, we went to the RNC this year in Cleveland, and I got into a discussion with an anti-choice person who was protesting outside, and he saw me, and he screamed, Martin Luther King Jr. didn't die so that you could kill babies. And I was like, you are exactly right. That is very true. Martin Luther King Jr. had nothing to do with that, but it was just like, you're just going to scream and say anything. And I actually had a conversation with that person about that issue, but it was just funny how, you know, some person would be like,
do you know what's
crazy?
I didn't
feel bad about that.
When I worked as a clinic escort in Louisiana, the protesters were all pretty much, for the most part, white evangelical Christians, men, of course, but sometimes they bring their wives and their children and push their strollers with their babies in them in front of cars coming into the parking lot. But they, when there were black patients coming in, they didn't say anything to them. They only tried to dissuade white patients from getting abortions. And that was 25 years ago, and I feel like that kind of set the tone for the way I feel about the whole anti-choice movement.
Well, and I would also say that not only did Martin Luther King not die for killing babies, no one has died for killing babies because no one's killing babies.
Right.
And so I often like to say to them, you know, because if you're on Twitter and you know of a baby killing racket, I'll go with you to stop that. Instead, you're just on Twitter tweeting about baby killing, and that seems a little cold.
You know what?
Maybe get off your ass and go stop the baby killing.
What's interesting, though, and you brought it up, Liz, is that sure, you get death threats and you get your, you know, a fat, ugly cunt, ABC, or all of the above, you know, and posts and. But there are also people who are like, look, I agree with you, but you should be more quiet about it.
Yeah.
And
yeah, those are worse.
Yeah. It can be men or women. And I find that response very curious, because I think, what about this is making you so uncomfortable about me just talking about an experience? And I think that's kind of what you guys do.
Well,
like,
that's
we're
the,
talking about it.
That's the more stigmatizing thing, actually. We expect the haters, right? You expect the haters. But yeah, when it's, I feel like some of our most important work is to, when people say, well, no one's for abortion. It's like, I am for abortion. I'm 100% for abortion. And so when they say things like, but it's like, you know, no one makes that decision lightly. No, some people actually have no problem saying, you want to know what? I'm pregnant. Fuck that shit. I don't want to be pregnant in the next 5 days. That's what I don't want to be. And so, but that's not everyone. For some people, it's incredibly important, and it's incredibly traumatic, and it takes a lot of thought, and it takes a lot of, whether it's with their God, their family, in a wanted pregnancy. So that's why I always say there's no one's abortion is the same, but it feels like the
it's
stigma.
It's still trying to control a woman.
Yeah.
Like, you should feel bad, or you should be sad, or
yeah,
you should never forget this, mm-hmm, and you should be traumatized for life,
right,
and you shouldn't be talking about it right now.
It's not just about the decision, it's about how you're supposed to feel
yeah
about it. Right?
Yeah, you shouldn't be talking.
I want to jump on the God thing, because this is something, I'm Muslim, and in my religion, it's actually not against my religion to have an abortion in the first trimester. It's just not. So I always feel like this is a religious law. Like, whether we like it or not, it's not a scientific law, it's a religious law. And I'm one of those really, like, I think it's interesting. I'm actually the type of person that would die before I got an abortion. But I will also die to make sure that women have the right to make that choice. And that's what you guys were saying, that it's a personal choice. In my case, due to some health issues, I will actually die if I get pregnant. And I did get pregnant once, and I was so happy that I had a choice, that I wasn't being forced to risk my life, and I wasn't being forced to end a pregnancy. I had a choice. And that's just what I want to protect for other people,
yeah,
that choice. I don't want to have that choice be, you want me to kick you down the stairs?
But Mason, if you had been a stronger person, you would have chosen death over
yes, I can care.
Yes.
And then the day that I miscarried, as I was leaving, the nurse was like, don't worry, sweetie, you can try again. And I was like, I didn't try in the first place. And now I make sure to put an aspirin between my legs so that never, ever, ever happens.
That works.
Yeah. And I also just think, that anybody who, when you look at these laws, and forget about the trap laws that we talk about with the extended hallways and all that bullshit that's designed to close down clinics, the insidious laws that are on the books, 24, 48, 72-hour waiting bans, counseling that's inaccurate, all of that is designed to tell people that we don't trust women. And if we actually keep these laws on the books, it's not going to just be about whether or not we trust women to have abortions. It's going to be, women are frivolous in their thought, and we shouldn't really trust them to run our banks or be president. And so I think that people need to really look at these laws that are designed to make women seem unstable, because that is really what is happening, and that is another eye-opening thing that I really want people to know, that
you mean how blood comes out
shit
of our wherever.
Yes, and then we don't die.
Yeah.
Like, they should be terrified. We bleed for 5 days and we don't die. Like, fucking,
if you're bleeding from more than one hole, go to the doctor. That's what I always
I don't even know which hole.
In the last
last maybe 2 minutes I have with you before I have to let you go and get ready for this show, I want to pose one last question to all of you, which is, so thinking back to years ago when The Daily Show was getting up and running with Jon Stewart in that iteration, and now since then we've had the era of The Colbert Show, we've now entered John Oliver, Samantha Bee. Is comedy the new way of taking on serious issues and actually moving towards progress when it comes to public opinion, public understanding on policy decisions? Is that the direction that we're headed in?
Well, I have to go back and say it's not the new way. It's sadly, I mean, we've had George Carlin, Richard Pryor, Dick Gregory, you know, Roseanne. I mean, I can tell you there's been sitcoms and comedy forever where we have taken on these issues. I think the greater question is, what's wrong with our media that comedy has become? When people are sobbing because Jon Stewart's retired from his show, instead of being like, what the fuck is wrong with my media outlets that I'm sobbing that the comedian is quitting? Like, the fact that that is not the question is profound, because while comedy is one piece of the puzzle, comedy can't drill down. It can't be the puzzle. And it's, you know, it has to be. If all those shows that you mentioned are on corporate networks that allow you to be funny and raise some issues, but then you're just becoming an anger fluffer, and those people can't give you a call to action, which is one of the reasons that I, when I looked at what I was going to try to do with my life, and I thought, I really like doing exactly all the things you said, but I also want to give people something to do. Like, go do this thing, be part of this thing, and you can't do that, so I can do that with this organization and with my lovely friends who've decided to join me.
I think that it is different because a lot of young people, and it's been shown, do get their news from these sources. And
more than get their news from MSNBC or CNN or Fox News.
Maybe they should. When people like Don Lemon are saying, well, if Bill Cosby made this woman give him a blowjob, why didn't she bite him? Like, you have this person on, and I look at Don Lemon and I'm like, you're a gay male. Aren't you on my side as a persecuted sort
also
of
as a
person? The male hosts have not really taken on the issue of abortion and choice, and it might be because they don't feel like it's their purview and they aren't entitled to it, and that's why it's so thrilling to see Samantha Bee go for it and just bust all the balls in the joint. It's something I'm elated after I watch her show. And hi, Sam. I think you're great.
Man, the thought of her listening to my show is making me giddy.
I'll tell her too.
Heart's fluttering.
They both said it all. I feel like comedy, for me, growing up, was what drove me towards wanting to be involved in issues. And I think that can be a good beacon for the young people, that they're like, okay, that's funny, but also what can I do seriously? And that I found my serious to complement the funny to go together. And so that's my hope, that the comedy just keeps making people want to take action and vote and get out there and stop the politicians from just having ridiculously draconian laws.
It's better than a sober speech making.
Yeah.
You know, it's better to get it in with laughs, I think.
Yeah.
You're right.
Well, and I think that for everyone, I'm speaking for myself, but the reason that I love being around these women is because it's not just about the message, it's about being funny. I think that, like, for me, I'm funny first. And if I'm funny first and I can talk about anything from Islamophobia to reproductive rights to disability, but still be funny first, then I'm going to reach people that, like you guys said, are not going to be reached by the 7-page article and whatever blog, you know?
Yeah, I think that's right. I think that even when I write jokes, and I've written, my stand-up has been political since 1991. I've been, written jokes basically on that. But I always weave in personal stories within that, because I feel like complete human beings are people that you actually trust. So when people see your full thing about your family and your animals and your politics and your thing, if they like you despite themselves, then you win. And laughter is a visceral response. So if someone laughed at something you said, they can't take it back. You know, you don't laugh at people you don't like. You just don't. It's just not a thing.
Well, thank you all for coming on Talk Poverty Radio to make me laugh and to really take on an issue that, as I said, is close to my heart. So here's hoping you guys open some eyes and some other parts, too, tonight.
Some whatever. We'll be performing abortions in the alley. Yeah.
That's what they always do.
Buy one, get one free.
Liz, Sarah, Joyelle, Maisoon, thank you so much for joining Talk Poverty Radio.
Thank you.
And do tell Samantha Bee to listen to my show.
And that's the show. Thanks for listening to Talk Poverty Radio on the We Act Radio Network and the Progressive Voices Network. You can find us anytime at www.talkpoverty.org/podcast, where we have a full archive of all past shows. You can also listen to us anytime as a podcast on iTunes and send us your pitches to info@talkpoverty.org. Thanks for listening.
I work and get paid like minimum wage. Sights to hit the clock by the end of the day. Hop from downtown into the hood where I stay. The only place I can't afford, cause my block ain't safe. I spend most of my time working, trying to bring in the dough.